It's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. There's ongoing fallout and calls for an investigation after claims made by former acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe in a recently televised interview. Meanwhile, House Democrats are launching an investigation into the Trump administration's dealings with Saudi Arabia. Members of Congress are responding to the president's declaration of a national emergency on the southern border, and a familiar face jumps into the 2020 presidential race. Our question for you this week, how do you feel about that national emergency declaration at the southern border? Does this free up necessary funds for a wall, or is this an abuse of presidential powers? How would you like to see Democrats and Republicans respond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start off with Andrew McCabe, former acting FBI director. This interview on 60 Minutes got a lot of attention. McCabe said it's possible that President Trump could be a Russian asset, mentioned that there was a brief conversation about using the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office. What all have we heard from McCabe since then?
Well, that's right. There's a lot to unpack there, and he has been, in fact, making the media rounds promoting his new book on his time at the FBI and in dealing with President Trump. I think one additional takeaway is this idea that he, in this revelation, that he says he went ahead and briefed the members of Congress known as the Gang of Eight, the top eight officials on intelligence matters, including Paul Ryan at the time, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. He says he briefed them back in 2017 that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation into the president about whether he was, in fact, working for the Russian government, as you mentioned, this idea of him being a Russian asset. And so I thought that was significant. He says there was zero pushback. Nobody questioned it when he brought that to their attention. And so I think that's significant, and I think that's something that's going to be looked at by members of Congress going forward.
Here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina responding to McCabe's comments about the possibility of invoking the 25th Amendment. Here's a listen.
We're going to find out what happened here, and the only way I know to find out is to call the people in under oath and find out, you know, through questioning, who's telling the truth, because the underlying accusation is beyond stunning.
Can you talk about congressional reaction now to that McCabe interview, including what we just heard there from Senator Graham?
Well, obviously, Trump's allies, including Lindsey Graham and Mark Meadows, the Freedom Caucus chairman, they're very upset at this idea that there was a conversation between McCabe and the deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. This would have been after James Comey's firing, but the fact that there was a discussion happening in within DOJ and the FBI raising the specter of invoking the 25th Amendment, and as you know and your listeners know, that would trigger a process of actually removing a president from office who, you know, who his cabinet deems unfit to carry out his duties. And so these were, according to McCabe, real conversations that were happening. And, you know, let's just take a step back. I mean, we're talking about this idea of removing a president from office under the 25th Amendment. We're talking about this idea that people believed the president was a Russian asset. I mean, you know, it's sort of something out of, you know, some kind of mystery thriller movie or something like that. But these were real conversations that were, in fact, happening.
And now the New York Times put out a report this week, extensive report about pressure from President Trump and his administration, allies in Congress, to protect the president from various investigations, including the Mueller probe, including Southern District of New York investigations. What were some of the key takeaways from that report?
Right. The Times reported that the president actually called late last year. He called his acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, to see if he could intervene and install a key Trump ally named Jeffrey Berman, who happens to be the top prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, to oversee this Michael Cohen case. This was, as your listeners will remember, this is the case about hush money payments to silence women who had alleged affairs with then-candidate Trump back in the 2016 campaign. And so It's raising more concerns that the president has engaged in obstruction of justice. Normally, a president will steer clear of investigations, especially when he appears to be the target of that investigation. But in this case, Trump is very much has taken a hands-on posture, and that is raising concerns from members of Congress, including Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, who says if these reports are true, then this is a clear case of obstruction of justice and has even called for the president to resign.
And earlier today, the president responded to the New York Times report, tweeting, "The New York Times reporting is false. They are a true enemy of the people," enemy of the people in all caps there. The president doesn't say specifically what he thinks the New York Times got wrong, but clearly not happy with this report.
Yeah, this is just more of Trump's aggressive stance against not only the New York Times but the Washington Post and what he sees as the mainstream media at large, and obviously folks in journalism like myself and others believe that this is creating a very dangerous, these are very dangerous types of words and rhetoric aimed against journalists at a time when a lot of journalists are under threat. And so we don't think it's very helpful, but the president has taken this position and posture against the press when he feels he is being unfairly covered.
Talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Well, maybe the biggest story of the last week or so, Scott, this national emergency declaration from the president saying it allows him to tap into money intended for other things, military construction and more, to fund construction on the U.S.-Mexico border. What are we seeing? We have this lawsuit now from a bunch of states, not including Wisconsin, not yet anyway. What are you hearing from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, I think you're seeing this sort of, dual track of opposition forming, one with these lawsuits from California and other states, 16 states across the country. The second track is obviously opposition in Congress. And what we're seeing right now is the House of Representatives, led by Democrats, preparing a resolution of disapproval, essentially that would block the president from going down this path of using his executive power to declare this national emergency at the border. And we're hearing that this resolution is going to be introduced as soon as Friday. We could see a vote in the House as early as next week. This is being led by Joaquin Castro, who is the brother of Julian Castro, who is running for president, as well as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the sort of liberal freshman firebrand from New York. And so they've already collected 90 signatures. It will clear the House easily because that's led by Democrats. What we're watching for is what happens in the Senate. And what we think is that all Democrats will be opposed to it, and a number of Republicans will defect from the president and join Democrats in supporting that resolution that will, again, create another standoff between Congress and the president of the United States over this issue. What remains to be seen is how many Republicans, cross the aisle and join with Democrats. The main concern, I think, from Republicans that we've heard of in the Senate is they think this sets a incredibly bad precedent for future presidents, especially if you have a Democratic president. The Republicans are warning that if you have a Democratic president, they could simply declare a national emergency on climate change or a national emergency, in terms of the gun violence epidemic. And they think it just sets a horrible precedent and takes power away from the Congress.
And do I have this right procedurally, Scott? I think I've read that the form of this resolution means that if the House passes it, the Senate actually has to vote on it. So Mitch McConnell, say, couldn't just let it ride and not bring it to a vote.
I think that's right. I think there, based on some of the reporting I saw, there was a conversation between Mitch McConnell and the president last week, where McConnell basically told the president, "Look, we will support you in this declaration, this emergency declaration on the border, but you have to know that we likely will have to take up a resolution of disapproval and McConnell is saying to the president, basically, I may lose some Republicans in that vote, and you just have to be well aware of what you're getting yourself into.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's our weekly roundup of national political news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this issue we're talking about now, the president's national emergency declaration to free up funding for a border wall. How do you feel about this? What do you want to see from Democrats and Republicans in Congress? Should they pass this resolution of disapproval? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. We're digging into some of the latest national political news. We were talking about the emergency declaration and the congressional response. We had an email from Jim. Jim says, why isn't anyone talking about the abject mean-spiritedness of Trump shutting down government for 34 days if the emergency order was an option to begin with? Hundreds of thousands of people were facing real-world issues with finances all for nothing. Has that been a point of criticism, Scott? Like, why not just make that emergency declaration instead of the shutdown in the first place?
Yeah, a lot of people have said, look, Trump could have done this before we all went through this 35-day shutdown, the longest shutdown in U.S. history. In fact, what Democrats had offered on the table in terms of border security, in terms of a border security package, was actually more substantial than what President Trump ultimately got after the 35-day shutdown. And so people have certainly made that argument. Obviously, a lot of thousands of Americans, federal government workers as well as contractors, went through a lot of pain when we went through that shutdown, and I think everyone was simply relieved that we didn't enter a second shutdown last week.
Let's bring on a caller before we move on to other issues. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hello.
Hello, yes. My comment was just that it's really important for us to take back the government. I don't care which party is in office. There are branches of the government for a reason, and they were set up by the framers to protect that purpose. We really need to have people understand they cannot be the king in this country, because this is not a kingdom, it is a democracy, and that just because you don't get the funding, it doesn't mean that you call this a national security issue. And I actually believe climate change is a bigger national security issue than the border wall. So,
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. And some members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation, including Republicans like James Sensenbrenner, are raising some of those separation of powers issues. It's also part of the lawsuit by multiple states. Scott, this is a fundamental issue in this argument.
Well, that's right. And you know, sort of to the caller's point, I think when you look at the recent polling, one poll came out, NPR PBS Marist poll, showed that while 85% of Republicans do back Trump's executive action, the majority of Americans, 60%, are opposed. And 60% of Americans also say there's no emergency at the border, as Trump insists. And another 60% say that the move should be challenged in the courts. And so while this appeals to Trump's base ahead of the 2020 election, that's something he's trying to energize his voters and energize his base and get them out to the polls before 2020, he's losing nearly all Democrats and a lot of independent voters that will be very important in the general election. We're of course a long ways away from the 2020 election, but these are some of the things to be thinking about heading into that race.
Thanks for the call, Susan. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Scott, Democrats on the House Oversight and Reform Committee say they're launching an investigation into the Trump administration's dealings with Saudi Arabia as related to nuclear energy technology. Can you give us some of the background on that?
Yeah, just real quick, you know, this is another example of Congress demonstrating and sort of asserting itself that it's not happy with the Trump administration's coziness with the Saudi royal family and the government. The Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings this week said his company would be diving into an investigation into Trump's Trump political appointees who they said are rushing to provide nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia, while there were a number of ethical and legal professionals and government sounding the alarm bells about this potential move. And so, you know, it really comes against this backdrop of the killing of the U.S.-based journalist from the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi, which intelligence officials insist that the Saudi crown prince had something to do with this, that he ordered Khashoggi to be murdered in the embassy in Turkey. And a number of folks in Congress and the intelligence community believe Trump has not spoken out aggressively enough against the crown prince, bin Salman. And so, you know, there's a number of sort of geopolitical issues here, but also sort of speaks to the relationship between Congress and Trump when it comes to foreign policy, particularly with the Saudi government.
And retired General Michael Flynn is at the center of this story, as he has been in a lot of other stories over the last few years. He, during the transition, he was also apparently consulting with a nuclear energy group that was hoping to do this, to help Saudi Arabia build nuclear power plants. So that's a name that maybe the Trump administration doesn't want to see back in the news again.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned Michael Flynn. I mean, he's sort of the nexus, you know, between this Saudi nuclear deal as well as the Russia probe that Robert Mueller has been focusing on. And I think Flynn was one of the earliest indictments in that probe. And so it's a familiar name. It's a name we haven't heard about, quite frankly, in a while. But you know, it's certainly interesting, and you know, one other aspect to this, you know, with members of Congress and lawmakers trying to assert their authority in terms of the balance of powers with the president, the House and Senate have also passed this resolution to force Trump to restrict U.S. troops in the Saudi coalition that's fighting in the civil war in Yemen. It's all sort of related, but Trump has opposed this resolution, and so the way things are looking right now, this will likely set up the first veto of the Trump presidency. That could be coming in a number of weeks.
And finally, Scott, you mentioned the presidential election in some ways is a long way away, but news keeps coming out each and every day. A familiar face and voice joined the roster of 2020 Democratic hopefuls this week. Here's a listen.
Somebody can come before you and say, look, I want to do A and I want to do B, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, the only way that real change takes place is when millions of people stand up, fight back, and say, enough is enough. We're going to have a government that works for all of us, not just the few.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders there in a non-surprise announcement saying he's having another go at running for president. Can you talk about Bernie Sanders' role in this growing Democratic field, Scott?
Well, he made a big splash this week, and we had, as you mentioned, been expecting him to jump in, but the big surprise was the amount of money that he was able to raise in the first 24 hours. You know, after Kamala Harris of California dove into the race a few weeks ago, she announced a big fundraising haul of $1.5 million in her first 24 hours to sort of demonstrate the excitement behind her campaign and that she had a lot of momentum as the primaries take off. Well, Bernie hauled in close to $6 million in the first 24 hours of his announcement, dwarfing Kamala Harris's and most and all of the other candidates who have jumped in so far. And so he's saying, look, I'm a force to be reckoned with. I have energy. I've captured the energy on the left. You know, this is going to be probably a battle of liberals as they seek the Democratic nomination in 2020. And Bernie is saying, you know, I've got a lot of momentum and I am a force to be reckoned with.
It is different this time around with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. He could portray himself as really the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and their standard bearer. There's a lot of candidates and a lot of them in that same sort of ideological terrain this time around, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that sort of speaks to this idea that maybe there's room for somebody, a more moderate, pragmatic candidate, to sort of, you know, cruise up the middle, and while the folks on the left are battling it out, somebody could sneak by and possibly win the primary. It might be a little far-fetched, but, you know, it's entirely possible. One thing we noticed in the past week was Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, who also announced she's running for president. One thing that stood out during one of her town halls is she said she was not for free four-year college education, like many of the other candidates have been. She basically said it's something that she would love to see happen, but she's a realist, and it simply was something that the country could not afford at this time. So I'd be watching Klobuchar to see if she tries to take up space in the middle as other folks are duking it out on the left.
And somebody was pointing out that around this point in the last Republican primary, Jeb Bush and Scott Walker were seen as the big front runners. So maybe it's too soon to make predictions, right, Scott?
I think so. And when you talk to a lot of members of Congress in terms of who they're supporting or endorsing in the primary, sure, you have the Vermont lawmakers who are backing Bernie and a handful of California lawmakers who are backing Kamala Harris. But by and large, most people are staying out of it for now because the field is simply too wide open, and they're not sure actually who's going to win the nomination. It's far too early at this point.
Scott, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly roundup of the top stories in national politics. Share your thoughts on these issues. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.